Ireland's constitution says a woman's place is in the family home. Many Irish women say that language can only be described as
outmoded, outdated, sexist, and very reductive to one particular type of womanhood that was acceptable in Irish society.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. More on the divisive referendum to change the Irish constitution and our investigation into orphanages in Uganda.
Orphan care is not as pretty as it seems. There's a lot of bad things that happen in this sector.
We have an example of one place that's doing it right. Then Morocco's water shortage means new restrictions for the country's beloved bathhouses called hammams.
Do hammams really waste water? Yes.
Those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in on this Thursday. Ireland's constitution says something that annoys a lot of people, that a woman's duties are in the home. The nation's foundational document from 1937 says the Irish woman's life within the home is necessary for the common good. Now the Irish government plans to change that. Tomorrow, on International Women's Day, a referendum will put the question to Irish voters, asking if they want that specific clause replaced. As the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, the issue is proving more divisive than anyone expected.
The 29th of December, 1937. That was the day the Irish Constitution came into force.
We are in O'Connell Street, Dublin, on this, the first Constitution Day of the State of Erin, 29th of December, 1937.
A parade to mark the occasion was held on O'Connell Street, the main avenue that runs down the centre of Dublin city. The event was broadcast live on national radio. Eamon de Valera, the Prime Minister, or Taoiseach as he's known in Ireland, promised that the new constitution would give women a privileged position in Irish society. The document basically says that mothers should not have to go out to work to the neglect of their duties in the home. A woman's life in the home, the constitution says, is a source of support to the state, which is necessary for the common good.
What it was reflecting was a desire for all women to be wives and mothers. And that was the most desirable and respectable model of Irish womanhood.
This is Mary McAuliffe, a historian and director of gender studies at University College Dublin. Ireland, in the late 1930s, was a deeply conservative country. And McAuliffe says the influence of the Catholic Church was everywhere. But the Prime Minister's own childhood might have played a part too in the way women were written about in the Constitution. De Valera was more or less abandoned by his own mother as a child, McAuliffe says.
He was sent home from America. He was born in New York to be brought up by his grandparents in County Limerick. And he always valued and wanted every child to have a mother in their lives. So he was going to ensure it was written into the Constitution.
McAuliffe has been calling for the Women in the Home article, as it's known, to be removed for decades. It's sexist and outdated, she says. And last March, on International Women's Day, Leo Varadkar, the current Irish Prime Minister, promised to put the issue to a national vote.
Throughout history, women and girls have carried a disproportionate share of caring responsibilities and have been discriminated against in the home and the workplace. We can be the generation that changes all of that.
Varadkar proposed a new article that removes the reference to women's duties in the home and replaces it with a clause that says the government will recognise the care provided by all members of a family. But his proposal has proven divisive.
One of the reasonings behind holding this referendum is to make the Irish Constitution a gender-neutral constitution.
Colette Colfer is a lecturer in religious studies and social ethics at a university in Waterford in the southeast of Ireland.
I think that that leads to the erasure of women in particular and mothers. Motherhood is not gender neutral.
Colfer says the proposed new wording ignores the fact that the majority of those who stay at home and raise children in Ireland are still women.
89.9% of the numbers of people looking after the home or family in 2022 were women.
Colfer says she worries that any changes in the constitution might affect financial benefits too, like what's known as the children's allowance, which all mothers in Ireland are entitled to. The government says benefits will not be affected. But the referendum isn't just dividing people on the issue of gender.
My name is Alana Murray. I am a law student and a disability advocate. I am disabled myself.
Murray, who uses a wheelchair, is advocating for a no vote. The government says the new clause recognises the contribution that all carers in the home make to Irish society. And they've added a phrase that says the state will strive to support them. But Murray says it's all just words.
It doesn't oblige the state to do anything. And without that obligation, the state won't act.
The responsibility will still rest mainly on the family, she says. It doesn't oblige the state to provide any help to people with disabilities or carers. A new clause needs to be written that compels the state to provide that support, she says. But others say the new article is a step in the right direction. Lindsay O'Donovan is a full-time carer. Her son Jack has quadriplegic cerebral palsy and needs 24-hour care. O'Donovan spoke to Irish broadcaster RTE this week.
As it stands at the minute, carers aren't recognised in the Constitution. So I will definitely be voting yes because, as things stand, I fight for every support that I get.
All the main political parties in Ireland are advocating for a yes vote. But in the last few weeks, a number of human rights groups have also agreed with the concerns of people with disabilities and carers. And that's left gender studies lecturer Mary McAuliffe questioning her support for the change.
I'm still considering my vote on the care referendum, but the thought that the articles in the home would remain in for another 87 years is making me heart sore as a feminist.
And McAuliffe is far from alone. Polls show almost a third of the Irish public now say they don't know how they will vote in tomorrow's referendum. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
During his State of the Union address tonight, President Biden is expected to talk about a new U.S. effort to get desperately needed humanitarian aid to Gaza. News reports based on anonymous administration officials say the U.S. military will help set up a temporary port on the Gaza coast. It would be used for aid deliveries into the Palestinian territory. 5 months after the start of Israel's military campaign, Gaza is facing possible famine. Health officials there say people are starting to die of malnutrition. The temporary port would allow the U.S. military and its allies to send aid from Cyprus. Aid groups say their efforts to deliver supplies by land have been badly hampered because of lawlessness and difficulty coordinating with the Israeli military. Meanwhile, legal efforts aimed at stopping the war are taking shape. Germany is facing a case at the International Court of Justice that calls for Berlin to stop sending weapons to Israel. Nicaragua filed the claim and accuses Germany of being part of a genocide in the Gaza Strip. It is early days for this particular case, but it's part of a larger cross-border legal effort to use the courts to halt the war in Gaza. Rebecca Collard reports from Berlin.
One of the cases is being brought in a German court on behalf of Germans with family in Gaza, accusing German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and senior members of his cabinet of complicity in genocide, and points to Germany's unwavering political support for Israel. Nadia Samor is one of the lawyers.
Their practice of giving permission to weapons exports to Israel is a form of aiding and abetting genocide.
Germany has authorized more than 300 million euros in military exports to Israel since October, a nearly tenfold increase. And while the U.S. is still the largest supplier of arms to Israel, Germany now makes up more than a quarter of Israel's military imports. Several other European countries supply Israel with military equipment as well.
If you look at the Arms Trade Treaty, for instance, or if you look at EU laws on arms exports, but also the Geneva Conventions, if you know that your weapons will be used for violations of humanitarian law, then you shouldn't export those weapons.
Dirk Jan Jeving is with Oxfam Novib, one of several organizations that brought a case against the Dutch government. Last month, a Dutch court ordered the government to stop exporting F-35 fighter jet parts, citing the large number of civilian casualties and the destruction of homes, hospitals, schools and religious buildings in Gaza caused by Israeli bombing. Jan Jeving says they brought the case after months of meeting with government officials.
We shared with them our concerns about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, but we also shared our concerns about violations of international humanitarian law by all parties to this conflict in Gaza. But unfortunately, all of those meetings were quite fruitless. So going to the court, it was really like the last option that we had in order to force the Dutch government to do the right thing.
These cases are part of a growing movement to what's been called lawfare, using legal means to pressure governments and hold leaders to account. Similar cases were also brought in the U.S. and the U.K. Leon Castellanos-Yankovic is with the Asser Institute for International and European Law.
International justice is very slow, probably also very ineffective in most cases, but we do see that it moves conversations forward.
He says the same applies to domestic lawfare cases, that even though few may have concrete outcomes, they can shift public debate. He also says domestic courts in different countries can influence each other.
The F-35 case here in the Netherlands, the cases that are happening right now in the United States, in Germany, in the UK, you can be sure that all of these judges are reading each other's decisions or are at least very much aware of what's being discussed and debated in these other locales.
And we have jetzt die Gelegenheit im Rahmen der Pressekonferenz, dass
here in Germany, Nadia Samor and the other lawyers bringing the case against senior German officials say they know it's unlikely Chancellor Scholz will be in court on genocide-related charges anytime soon.
But we hope that this criminal complaint will form pressure on the government because there are exports that are still to be decided upon. And we believe that this criminal complaint now will force him to overthink this decision.
In a statement to the world, a German government spokesman said Israel has the right to defend itself and weapons exports would continue with careful consideration on a case-by-case basis, taking into account foreign and security policy considerations. Israel has fiercely rejected the allegations of genocide and says it is defending its people while taking the utmost care for Palestinian civilians. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Berlin.
It is official.
Let me be the very first to welcome Sweden as a party to the Washington Treaty and the 32nd member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken there speaking in Washington today as Sweden officially joined NATO. 2 years ago, the Scandinavian nation put aside two centuries of neutrality to seek membership in the transatlantic military alliance. It was, of course, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that pushed the Swedes to do it. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson was there with Blinken today at the State Department. He said joining NATO is a major step, but also a natural one.
Membership means that we are coming home to the Alliance for Peace and coming home to the Alliance for Freedom, to which many democracies already belong.
Tonight, Kristersson plans to be a guest of honor when President Joe Biden delivers the State of the Union address to Congress. Sweden's neighbor, Finland, became a NATO member last year, but it's taken a couple of years for Sweden to formally join because the process was held up by NATO members Turkey and Hungary. Turkey had accused Sweden of harboring Kurdish exiles that the Turkish government regards as terrorists. And Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, maintains close ties with the Kremlin, which opposes the expansion of NATO. Still ahead this hour, the classic bathhouses of Morocco serve a practical function and an important social one, too. Now drought is putting hammams on notice for their water usage. Stay with us for that and more. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Military juntas have seized control of 8 civilian governments in West Africa in just the past 4 years. 3 of those countries, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, are now creating a unified force to fight terrorist groups. To find out more, we reached Oleyinka Ajala. He teaches politics and international relations at Leeds Beckett University in the UK.
The main reason why they toppled the democratically elected government was because they argued the democratic governments were not doing enough to fight insecurity. So they have to be seen as doing something because insecurity has increased in these 3 countries. They've not been able to fight the scourge of insecurity individually. So they're coming together and trying to see if they will be able to go back to the people and say, well, we came with the mandate of fighting insecurity. We are reducing insecurity. Because they know that after a while, if they are not making any headway, the people might revolt again, or there might all be some internal coups. Mm.
The Russian mercenary group Wagner has been on the ground in the region. Have those ties strengthened lately?
Yes, it's strengthened lately because for the first time, the Wagner group were deployed into Burkina Faso. Earlier this year, I think in January, the first contingent landed in Burkina Faso. But now they are now operational in Burkina Faso and Mali. And there are indications that more troops are going to join them in the fight against insurgency. So we don't know what is going to happen with Niger at the moment, because the Niger is still, they still have the security pact with the U.S. The U.S. still has one of the biggest military bases in terms of the drone base in Agadez. So we don't know if they are going to sign a pact for Wagner Group to come to Niger, but at the moment they are fully operational in Mali and Burkina Faso.
Extremist groups in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso are said to be aligned with ISIS and al-Qaeda. What do we know about them?
We know that for over a decade, al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb had operated in that region. And more recently, we had Islamic State West Africa operating along the Lake Chad Basin, engaging Nigerian and Nigerian troops, and also around Mali and some areas in Burkina Faso.
These are fragile states where citizens complain about a lack of security, corruption, bad governance. Are the new military regimes in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso actually trying to tackle these sorts of issues for citizens?
Yes, they are, but it's a very difficult challenge for them because, you know, immediately they seized power in the individual states. Sanctions were imposed on them. So in addition to trying to fulfill their mandate, which is to fight corruption and also to fight insecurity, they then also had the issue of the economy, which was going down as a result of the sanctions imposed on them by the African Union and also ECOWAS. So this has impacted on their ability to deliver what they said they would deliver. But late last month, some of the sanctions have been lifted on these three countries, but it will take a while for the economies to begin to pick up again. They have lost a lot of resources from France, from the US, and even from the EU. So the bulk of the resources used to fight insurgents before came from these external partners. So the severing ties with these partners came with consequences of not having the resources to fight these insurgent groups. And this is my concern when I read that they formed this new security pact now, because it's unclear who is going to fund it and how they will get the funding, because the Sahel is a very, very, very big region. And fighting insurgency is very expensive, because when you're fighting them at a place, they just simply move to another place and begin to attack again from those regions. So they need a lot of human resources, they need a lot of firepower, and they need a lot of money to be able to confront these huge and growing insurgent groups.
Olayinka Ajala of Leeds Beckett University. He was describing plans by the military regimes in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, and their announcement that they'll join forces to fight terrorist groups. Like many places in Africa right now, Morocco is dealing with a water crisis, and it's having a very specific cultural impact. Public bathhouses or hammams will be closed 3 days a week in cities across Morocco. Some have completely shut down. Local officials had been tasked with implementing water-saving measures earlier this year. Mohamed Alhamzawi grew up in Morocco. He teaches Arabic at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. I asked him about the cultural significance of hammams in Morocco.
Basically, it's a space where they can conglomerate and they can meet each other on a more pragmatic, you know, level. It's cheap relatively to, you know, other ways of getting clean. So it's less than a couple dollars to go to a hammam. So it's a great way of getting clean for Moroccans who don't have water here. Traditionally, there are 3 to 4 rooms in hammam. You go first to the hottest room and you get sweat in there and all of that, and then start scrubbing that skin or cells. And a lot of Moroccans go to the hammam Thursday night or Friday morning, early morning, to go and get clean and ready for Friday prayer. The same thing goes for Ramadan, the night before Ramadan starts. For women, it's a very important place. Traditionally, there were no cafe spaces or public spaces for women. So the hammam was a place where they can go and, you know, socialize. That's also a place for them to, you know, have what we call bridal ceremonies. So the hammam as an institution in Morocco really takes up a big, big space. So it's very important.
You mentioned this is important culturally, it's important religiously, and it's an affordable way for folks to get clean if they don't have a hot water heater. So these restrictions shutting down hammams certain days a week or even entirely, I imagine they can't have gone over well with the public in Morocco. What are you hearing from folks you know there?
I mean, to be honest, they're not really happy about what the government is doing. For me, it's kind of like, you know, think about it from two perspectives. Do hammams really waste water? Yes. You know, something like 8,500 cubic meter per hammam, and we have thousands of them in Morocco. Also, you know, the heating sources, they're relying on wood, which is leading to shrinking forest. But that is still a very small, you know, number in terms of water consumption in Morocco. It still falls under the 10% that, you know, that the population uses. I feel like the government is ignoring the fact that the agricultural domain in Morocco, that's what's using up most of the water in Morocco, which is kind of like 80 to 85% of, you know, the water resources in the country. So, yeah, it makes sense for them to try to find these solutions, but I feel like they are short-sighted in that sense. They're like, you know, they're not really dealing with the major issue.
So do you fear that there's any danger here to this very long-seated tradition of going to the hammam now that they're being closed down on certain days or of individual bathhouses closing? Or is this more of a temporary annoyance?
I think, you know, like previous government initiatives, I feel like this, again, the burden will fall on the Moroccan layman. They basically now we're asking, you know, a big population, you know, of Moroccans to basically, you know, be responsible for water preservation, although they're not really the ones who are consuming that water. So, yes, this will affect the hammam as an institution, as a cultural aspect of Morocco. And like other parts of the Moroccan culture, the hammam will, you know, eventually become this more of a luxury, not a reality for Moroccans. And that's sad.
That was Mohamed Alhamzawi. He teaches Arabic at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. This is The World. When atomic bombs were dropped on Japan at the end of World War II, an American military film crew shot footage of the aftermath, but it was hidden from the public.
There was a concerted effort from the moment we returned with the film to see that American people and people throughout the world never saw this footage.
How that footage eventually got out is ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This week, we have been reporting on alleged abuses in orphanages, also known as children's homes. Decades of research shows these facilities can be bad for children's health and development, but millions of kids remain in them worldwide. Americans are some of the biggest donors to children's homes in countries including Uganda. And these donations have helped create a lucrative and hard-to-shutter industry around them. Every few years for the past decade, the problem of illegal children's homes in Uganda pops up in the local news, and government officials pledge to shut them down. This time around, Uganda's government is taking a more proactive approach by helping children's homes transition into something better. Some faith-based organizations are already on the right track. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gakandi, brings us the final part of her investigation.
The Wakiso district in central Uganda currently has 31 approved children's homes that are taking care of approximately 1,600 children. But the number of homes that are unapproved to operate is nearly twice that. In November, government officials said they were concerned about the increasing number of children's homes that are operating illegally. They said this is putting the lives of children at risk. One that has been cited by the government as illegal is Foodstep Uganda.
This is Foodstep Uganda, and today we dance for you to give you hope, to give you love, and to enjoy the time we are all in. We need to do this together. Thank you so much for your support to
Foodstep is an NGO created by Belgians Nathalie Selefet and her husband. It was founded in the 2000s, first to help rescue kids who were languishing in a rehabilitation center for street children that was effectively a children's prison. Archival videos show it was in a horrible state, not fit for children.
You know about the Foodstep home?
Yes.
Yes? Right. So we go there. So you will see even 40 other children coming out of Camp Ringis over there. So you will see a lot of brothers and sisters.
Selefet began taking some of these imprisoned street children in, and then expanded to take in babies and toddlers who she says were abandoned. According to their website, Foodstep has received funding from Belgium, the Netherlands, the UK, and the USA to meet their day-to-day needs. Their work has also brought in volunteers from all around the world. This young volunteer from Europe was one of them. She asked to remain unnamed because she fears the repercussions of speaking out.
I was young and naive. I wanted to go to Africa.
Around 2012, she says she landed in Uganda to volunteer. While she was there, she heard about the work Foodstep was doing.
I was 22 at the time, first time in Africa, and I was like, oh my God, I have to do something. I want to help. And I felt so sorry for these kids.
She says she ended up volunteering at Foodstep.
Especially in the beginning, I truly believed her story. Like, I really wanted to believe her. You know, you want to believe that this woman is changing kids' lives.
She tells me when she came back to volunteer at Foodstep for a second time, around 2014, she became concerned about the quality of the care being given to the kids. She says Foodstep was receiving a lot of donations, including one she had brought over in suitcases from Europe.
It wasn't showing in the care of the children, you know? Yeah, Nathalie was definitely capable of doing better in terms of food, in terms of especially care.
In Uganda, I meet with a former staff member who expressed similar concerns. She asked to remain anonymous because she fears the repercussions of speaking out. We are using a voiceover to mask her identity.
The care was, it wasn't so good. The way the kids used to eat food, the care wasn't so good, really. When donors come, you have to hide. You have to cover up.
She tells me the home became overcrowded and that the kids weren't receiving enough attention. She says many of the children there had families.
It would have been the best to come and go back to their families than staying in the organization for a long time, being there. They need their families. That's where they belong from. They need to go back.
Over the years, several serious allegations of neglect and abuse have been made about Foodstep, according to interviews with four former staff and volunteers. Eventually, they would be brought to the attention of one of Foodstep's donors, Wings of Support, a philanthropic initiative of employees of KLM Royal Dutch Airlines, which supports local organizations helping children around the world.
Wings of Support bestaat deze maand 15 jaar.
In 2017, former foreign volunteers reached out to the board of Wings of Support. They alleged several problems at Foodstep, including financial mismanagement, stopping children from reuniting with their families, and a lack of supervision of children that, they allege, was leading to unsafe conditions for the kids, including sexual abuse among some of the children. They met with some board members who promised to freeze their funding and send an external expert to Foodstep to look at how financial resources were being used and check in on the well-being of the children. Here's what Foodstep's owner Selefet wrote in her blog at the time, read out by a voice actor.
Tomorrow we will be checked by KLM Wings of Support. Please feel free to talk, ask questions, and give your opinion about me and Papa. Don't worry, we know we are okay. We are doing the right thing. We are a family. Love you all, Mama and Papa.
After the inspection, though, Wings of Support decided to stop funding Foodstep after they found the financial feedback from them to be insufficient. Foodstep's problems didn't end there. In 2018, they were included in a list of illegal children's homes slated for closure that was published in local media. But they remained open. Just a few months ago, in November 2023, Food Step's founder attended a meeting between government officials and the owners of illegal children's homes. The goal is to work with these homes to close them down and help them to resettle children into families or find alternative care options like foster care or putting them into legally operating homes. When I visited Food Step in January, though, the organization's Ugandan manager, Michael Okomo, seemed confident they wouldn't be shut down. Inside the home, I pass by dormitories and see a girl lounging in a bunk bed. About a dozen children are sitting outside watching TV. Founder Natalie Selefet isn't there. I reached out to her several times for comment about this story and about the allegations that Food Step has continued to operate illegally and about the allegations of issues with how they care for their children, but she did not respond to this. Food Step's Ugandan manager tells me they tried to get approved in 2019, but it wasn't granted. He says he doesn't know why. I asked government official Shafiq Butanda about it. He works in the government office overseeing children's homes.
Because the law says you must justify the need. So I strongly believe that maybe they want to recommend it because I've never seen the application here because of those reasons.
From the blog post of Food Step's founder, Natalie Selefet, it's clear that she's aware of the Ugandan government's efforts to close down illegal homes. In the past, she's written about how Food Step has been told that they are not allowed to take in more children. She said that the kids her organization cares for are there because they are, quote, unable to live with their families because of serious circumstances. She's also said that the kids who are there are all children assigned by the local authorities, children who can no longer live at home, kids who have led terrible lives, she's written. As I leave Food Step, I commented to the manager that there are fewer children than I expected. Last year, Food Step said they had 75 kids in their care, ages 3 months to 18 years old. The manager replies, that's because most of the kids are with their families, at their homes, for the school holidays, and will be back when the school term resumes.
That's an indication that they don't need to be operating as an institution in the first place, which is why most of them don't have approval.
That's Barbara Abe of the Catholic Relief Services, which has been working with the government to close down illegal children's homes, resettle children, and transition children's homes into providing other services, like addressing the root causes, driving and pulling kids into these institutions. Based on what I described about Food Step, Abe says,
they should be closed. They should be closed if the children in their care do not need that care.
This doesn't mean these children don't have other urgent, extreme needs. But experts and officials say if the problem is that a poor family doesn't have enough food to eat, give them food or help them generate income. If the problem is health, help with that. If the issue is education, help children go to school. Right now, Abe says, poor families in Uganda are being given an impossible choice.
The institutions and, you know, the situation created by that places kids in an environment where they feel like they have to choose education and basic needs over family. And we have to remember, these are all human rights.
In 1909, in the United States, the White House held a conference on children and concluded that kids in America shouldn't be separated from their families and taken to orphanages because of poverty alone. But Abe says the flood of money to children's homes in Uganda isn't helping.
It's hard for a country like Uganda to strengthen systems that prioritize family-based care if institutions still continue getting funding for the very same thing we're trying to do away with.
When I chat with other people in this sector, including those who run children's homes, they tell me the government isn't doing enough to make the alternatives to these institutions a reality. Some feel under attack and tell me they are the ones saving children who are falling through the cracks. Abe agrees that there is a lot more that needs to be done. She gives me one example of a program her organization, the Catholic Relief Services, is doing right now.
So we're working with a couple of local governments to set up foster care. So there are districts we're working in where you have almost 200 people registered, identified, trained, and approved as foster parents.
She says that's a big difference from a couple years ago. For this investigation, I focused a lot on the issues in children's homes in Uganda. But people in this field tell me there are a few good examples of organizations that are doing things the right way. One that several people recommended to me is Akisa Ministries. This faith-based NGO was started in 2010 to help disabled children who have been separated from their families because of abandonment, abuse, neglect, death of parents, and other reasons. I visit Akisa's office, which is in Jinja, in eastern Uganda. As I enter, I see staff wearing uniforms and hear children playing in the background.
At Akisa, we run a children's home. We run an orphanage with the goal of family permanency and getting kids back into family.
American Jared Shepman is Akisa's executive director. The children his organization is helping have disabilities and often face stigma in their communities.
We try to address the gap that exists in services that children with disabilities need and what a family might be able to access for their child.
Already, Akisa seems more professional and transparent than the other children's homes I've been investigating. In fact, they are accredited by the ECFA, or the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, which was created more than 40 years ago to help provide financial transparency to Christian organizations and to make sure donations are used faithfully and appropriately. Shetman tells me when he first came to Uganda to volunteer, he was a bit naive.
Orphan care is not as pretty as it seems. There's a lot of bad things that happen in this sector.
He thought the reason donors were being asked to sponsor children in countries like Uganda was because they were orphans without any family options. He was surprised to learn that wasn't the case. At the same time, Shetman emphasizes that doesn't mean there isn't a role for children's homes like his. Kids who are abandoned or abused need somewhere safe to go in emergencies.
But there's times and places where it is essential, but we're always concerned about the long-term future of these children and where they're going to end up.
After all, kids don't remain kids forever. They grow up. He says donors need to think about the future of the children they are supporting in homes. Shetman tells me he often hears from people who grew up in these institutions, called care leavers.
So often, care leavers will say, I would have rather chosen to be with my family and like even struggled to get a constant meal on the table than to grown up in an institution. There's this yearning inside everybody for connection and for family. And I love just coming back to this question. Like, what would you want for your own children? What would you want for yourself? No one would ever pick for their child to grow up in an institution.
He says increasingly these are the types of conversations that are happening within faith and especially Christian communities in the United States, which still accounts for a lot of the money that's going into children's homes or orphanages in Uganda.
I mean, one of the reasons why good work is happening around the world is because people are generous and people are willing to give money. Sadly, at the same time, like a lot of money that is given, and this is billions of dollars coming out of America from charitable givers and Christians, are going into organizations that, you know, we say are not best practice, that are not doing things that are in the best interest of the child. You know, in some ways, like it's money that could be better redirected somewhere else.
Like educating parents about how to take care of their disabled children, working to erase stigma, and training foster parents. So far, Akisa has been able to resettle, foster, or have adopted nearly half of the disabled children who have been in their care over the years. Shetman says before you support a children's home in Uganda, see if they are making an effort to do the same.
If you find an organization that you're going to support, like do some basic vetting of them. There are thousands and thousands of nonprofit organizations operating here in our country of Uganda, and many of them are operating without permits and registrations and compliance and those kind of things. And so ask the organizations you're giving to, are you registered? Do you have a permit? Do you have a strategic plan?
That's the message I've gotten again and again during this investigation from volunteers, owners of children's homes, kids who grew up in them, employees, and government officials. They've told me, thank you for wanting to help Ugandan children, but check where your money is going first. For The World, I'm Halima Gikhandi, Jinja, Uganda.
Our investigation this week has looked at the circumstances behind kids being classified as orphans and the abuse many of them allege in the children's homes that were supposed to take care of them. Tomorrow, join us for a conversation with Halima. We'll learn what could come next to help fix the problems she's been reporting on and hear the takeaways for people thinking of donating to orphanages abroad. At the State of the Union address tonight, lawmakers will have invited guests. As we mentioned earlier, Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson will be in the visitors' gallery. The parents of Evan Gershkovich will be there, too. Gershkovich is an American reporter detained in Russia a year ago and held on espionage charges widely seen as baseless. Several members of Congress invited guests from Israel, among them Mia Shem, who spent 50 days in captivity inside Gaza before being freed in late November. Also attending tonight's speech is Intima Salama, a Palestinian grad student from Gaza who has lost 35 family members since the start of Israel's military campaign. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Oppenheimer is likely to do well at the Academy Awards on Sunday. It has 13 Oscar nominations, more than any other film. But the movie has faced some criticism, too, for failing to show images of the victims of the atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. J. Robert Oppenheimer was, after all, the father of the atomic bomb. John Kalish reports on the U.S. government's suppression of footage shot by both Japanese and American film crews in the aftermath of the attacks.
In early August 1945, the U.S. detonated atomic bombs over the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. More than 100,000 people, mostly civilians, died in the bombings, which pushed the Japanese to surrender unconditionally and was thought to have avoided the loss of thousands of American lives in an invasion. Several months after the atomic attacks, a 24-year-old Air Force officer named Herbert Susan witnessed the devastation. Here he is in an oral history recorded at Columbia University that has never before been broadcast.
It's almost impossible to verbally explain the feeling of walking through miles and miles of just the shattered tops of what had been little homes with nobody in the area.
Susan directed an American military film crew that shot 15 hours of color footage with no sound. The footage of the military film crew is believed to be the only color footage of the aftermath of the atomic attacks. It shows the wreckage of a large cathedral, shadows burned into concrete, and victims being treated for burns. American military authorities confiscated black and white footage shot by Japanese film crews. After the war, Susan wanted to use the footage in a film that would warn humanity of the horror of nuclear war, but the film was designated top secret for more than 30 years.
There was a concerted effort from the moment we returned with the film to see that American people and people throughout the world never saw this footage.
Greg Mitchell is an author who watched all of the footage shot by American and Japanese film crews. He's critical of the one moment in the new film Oppenheimer in which a victim appears, a scene in which Oppenheimer is hallucinating.
The only victim of the bombing that you see is one young woman, and her face kind of melts a little. That's actually Christopher Nolan's daughter, and she's not even Asian.
Director Christopher Nolan has said that he didn't include footage of the victims because he wanted to tell the story through Oppenheimer's eyes. Naoko Wake is a history professor at Michigan State University who grew up in Japan. She says she reluctantly watched Oppenheimer.
It's such a missed opportunity for a Hollywood film that's being seen by so many people. Hollywood films are a great venue for not just entertain, but also inspire and educate people who may not be familiar with the actual consequences of the bomb. Unfortunately, again, we are facing this increased fear of nuclear war.
The footage shot by the American military crew was declassified sometime in the late 1970s. American and Japanese filmmakers did get to use it. In 1980, a dramatic miniseries about Oppenheimer was co-produced by the BBC and WGBH. It did use actual footage of the devastation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In one scene, Oppenheimer looks at a film showing a destroyed factory, school, and prison.
Penitentiary, 300 yards from blast. They had 140 prisoners there.
Any survivors?
No, they died in the cells.
Herbert Susan's daughter, Leslie, went to live in Hiroshima after her father died. While she was there, Leslie Susan connected with some of the survivors her father had filmed.
He really believed in film and images, not in words. And he thought that the only way you would stop the world from using nuclear weapons on people again was if you showed them color footage. Then they couldn't help but feel what he felt, that this couldn't be allowed again.
That's why author Greg Mitchell says the new film falls short.
Oppenheimer was maybe the last chance to reach a very large audience with a more honest appraisal of the use of the bomb. In that sense, the film is a failure, and it doesn't really matter how many awards it wins or how popular it was.
Oppenheimer is set to open at the end of the month in Japan, which is often the last foreign destination for Hollywood blockbusters. For The World, I'm John Kalish.
And finally, this one's for the doctors out there seeking a bit of adventure. The UK's National Health Service is recruiting general practitioners for the Scottish islands of Uist and Benbecula. This is from a recruiting video showing hikers enjoying the spectacular Scottish island scenery. The practice serves a small population of about 5,700, but you've got to be all in. Here's Gordon Jameson, the chief executive of the National Health Service for the Western Isles in Scotland.
These posts that are offered just now, they do the general medical services that any practitioner, general practitioner service does in Scotland. And then because they're on an island, they will be covering the out-of-hours unscheduled emergency care that comes forward.
Meaning you'd be on call 24/7. The salary is more than $190,000 a year, which is a lot more than the average doctor earns in Scotland's healthcare system. There's a relocation bonus, what they call a golden hello payment of nearly $13,000. But perhaps the biggest draw, Jameson says, and those of you who've seen the BBC crime series Shetland know this.
The landscapes and the beaches are the best that you'll come across in the world. There is every kind of outdoor pursuit or sport that you would want if you're a walker, a climber, and the air is as clean and as fresh as you'll come across anywhere in the world.
Even in this sales pitch, Jameson concedes that actually going into the waters off the northern coast of Scotland is ill-advised without a wetsuit. There are 5 general practitioner positions available on those islands in the Outer Hebrides. The gigs are open to Americans, but be prepared to do a lot of paperwork. There's another job opening, too, on the nearby Isle of Rum. Parents there are looking for a new school teacher for the 5 primary school students and 2 preschool kids. That salary package is worth a respectable $87,000. The catch? There are only 40 people living on the island, which locals describe as being very much off-grid. Thank you for being with us today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you right back here tomorrow.